This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken traveled to Beijing last week in an attempt to reboot U.S.-China ties. His February trip was aborted after Washington discovered that Beijing had launched a spy balloon over the continental United States. Does Blinken's visit portend a thaw in relations? Will the relationship be on a more stable footing henceforth? And why is that so crucial? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. Speaking to reporters in Beijing, Blinken said he had candid and substantive discussions with Chinese President Xi Jinping and top Chinese diplomat Wang Yi. VOA reporter Steve Herman said that Secretary Blinken raised in his meetings the provocative actions by China in the Taiwan Strait, as well as in the South and East China Seas. Washington very much wanted China to resume military-to-military communications with the United States, which they declined. Nonetheless, Ali Wine, a senior analyst with the Eurasia Group, told VOA's Nike Ching that, quote, Xi's decision to meet with Blinken suggests that China, not just the United States, appreciates the importance of slowing the deterioration of U.S.-China ties, closed quote. Well, joining us to discuss the U.S.-China relationship are two regional experts. Bonnie Glaser is director of the Asia Program at the German Marshall Fund in the United States, and that's a think tank based in Washington, and Yun Sun. She is senior fellow and co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center, a policy group also based in Washington. And both women join me via Microsoft Teams. Bonnie Glaser, let me begin with you. As I mentioned in the introduction, the trip was rescheduled after it was postponed in February due to that alleged spy balloon. So generally speaking, to what extent do you think this visit and the talks may have helped to stabilize this shaky relationship?
I think that Blinken's trip to China is a first step towards stabilizing the relationship. And both sides had low expectations for the visit. The U.S. side wanted to reopen some of the communication channels that have not been used regularly and begin to prepare for a potential meeting between President Biden and Xi Jinping later this year at APEC. So this was an airing of views and concerns and maybe even dispelling some misperceptions and an agreement to take some next steps to stabilize the relationship going forward in the U.S. parlance to put a floor under the relationship and stop further deterioration. And I think that the visit achieved those goals.
Turning to you, Yun Sun, do you think that the visit achieved those goals of putting a so-called floor on the relationship, as Bonnie said?
I think it's a good start, but we're still quite far away to actual stabilization of the bilateral relations. What this trip has achieved is a resumption of a process that was initiated by the Bali summit last November, but was interrupted by the balloon incident. So the resumption of communications, resumption of working level conversations and dialogues, this certainly will create the necessary but not sufficient condition for the relationship to stabilize. So it's a good start, but still a long way to go.
Before we get into some concrete outcomes, Bonnie, I wanted to ask you both to remind us of the major irritants that precipitated the need for these talks between these superpowers. Why is it so important to stabilize this relationship?
The reason they need to stabilize relations, first of all, goes beyond the irritants, because there's lots of global issues that require the United States and China to actually be talking to each other, whether you're talking about global health, pandemics, climate change, food security, the war in Ukraine. There's a lot of reasons that they should be talking to one another. The irritants have been mounting for years, decades. In fact, in some cases, if you talk about the problems with the economic relationship and, of course, the tariffs that the United States imposed on China and then China retaliated with its own tariffs, that goes back to the Trump administration, Chinese subsidies that go back for years to their companies and what many U.S. administrations have called an uneven playing field. But then you have the strategic competition that is going on in other areas. China's growing military capabilities, particularly in the nuclear sphere, that the United States would like to talk to China about. From the U.S. perspective, many people think about our past relationship with the Soviet Union and want to have similar conversations with China to achieve strategic stability and prevent a real nuclear arms race. But there are so many issues. Taiwan is number one on the list for China, and I will let Yun talk about that. But there's also many other regional issues. North Korea's growing provocations that need to be talked about, not an irritant, but a concern that affects the interests of both sides. So there's bilateral, there's regional, there's global issues that really do need to be discussed.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for widening the lens. There's no question that these two major greenhouse gas emitters, among other reasons, need to speak. As you said, these are major issues, the trade relationship subsidies, the violation of intellectual property rights that the United States has accused China of doing, strategic cooperation, nuclear sphere. Let me turn to you, Yun Sun, to add to what Bonnie said, in particular, if you want to address the tensions over Taiwan.
Bonnie is a real expert on this issue, but I can make some comment. I would say that if you look at China's periphery in the Asia region, the irritants are all over the place, right? In terms of the West Pacific, East Asia, from north to south, we have four issues. We have the Korean Peninsula, we have the East China Sea, we have Taiwan, and then we have South China Sea. And then moving westward, we have now U.S. trying to build up and strengthen its strategic cooperation with India. And China identifies that as a major threat to its regional security in the future. And then moving upward, we look at Afghanistan and Pakistan. The U.S. said these are regions that now China should carry a natural responsibility for their future. But the Chinese are worried that the U.S. is trying to use these two countries to sabotage China's backyard security. And then, of course, going north, there's also the issue of Russia and Ukraine and this growing mutual dependence between China and Russia in light of the Ukraine war. So the issues are certainly abundant. But looking specifically on the issue of Taiwan, we know that this is an issue that has occupied most of the time in terms of the bilateral negotiations, in terms of Qinggang's meeting with Blinken, and it was also a priority during Blinken's meeting with Xi Jinping. So I would say that U.S. and China fundamentally differ in terms of the future outlook of the Taiwan Strait and its status of Taiwan. I think the level of impatience in China has been growing about the current state of Taiwan, and Xi Jinping has demonstrated, both verbally and indirectly through his policy statement, that he wants the issue resolved. Well, of course, his wish is still subject to the constraints that China suffers realistically, but in terms of the Chinese effort to push U.S. out of the Taiwan Strait and to prevent U.S. from continuing its support to Taiwan, I think that's where we're seeing most of the conflicts and frictions coming out of the Chinese and the American militaries in the region.
Back to you, Bonnie Glaser, to look at more specifically what you see as takeaways from these talks, particularly on the most important issues that divide the United States and China regarding Taiwan. To what extent was there any greater understanding or just sort of both sides sticking to their views of the island? What about also the military-to-military context? Why do you think Beijing declined to resume these communication lines? And what other takeaways would you like to underscore?
Well, regarding Taiwan, based on the readouts, I think that both sides reiterated their positions and both sides are pretty well dug in. That said, I think that neither China nor the United States wants to have a military conflict over Taiwan or anything else. The United States continues to state its policies. Blinken said a one China policy, one that we have had for a very long time that has not changed. And I think that on the Chinese side, there is some questioning about whether or not the United States is as committed to the one China policy. And many in China believe that the U.S. is, they use the term hollowing out or salami slicing. So whatever reassurances were offered that U.S. policy hasn't changed, my guess is that those perhaps are not convincing to the Chinese. On the mil-mil issues, this is a very complicated issue. I think neither the United States nor China have managed the mil-mil relationship well in the last few years. When Biden first came to power, there was an unwillingness on the U.S. side to engage with China's defense minister because the Secretary of Defense wanted just to go to a higher level and meet with the vice chairman of the Central Military Commission. And that, I think, left a sour taste in the mouths of the Chinese. And that was finally dealt with last year. And then because there was a change of defense ministers, the new defense minister, Li Shangfu, was sanctioned. several years ago because China purchased S-400s and other military equipment from Russia. He was not personally responsible. He was just in a position in charge of what I believe was the General Armaments Department at the time. But you reap what you sow. I think we should not have sanctioned an individual. We should have sanctioned a department or unit under the PLA. So now we're in a situation where the Chinese are not ready to open up these military-to-military relationships. And one last point that I will make is that the United States has made it quite clear that we want to reduce the possibility of risk between our aircraft and ships that are operating in close proximity. And I think from China's perspective, the answer to that is that the U.S. just shouldn't be operating there. They view this from a political perspective, not a perspective based on international law. And China, I think, believes that by engaging in a risk reduction process, they will make it safer for the United States to operate there. And the Chinese believe by introducing greater risk, which we saw in the recent episode in the Taiwan Strait, when a Chinese ship cut in front within 150 yards of a U.S. military vessel, the Chinese believe that that will induce caution in U.S. operators and how they are sailing and flying around China's periphery. So I don't think we should be very optimistic about engaging in some effort to put guardrails and risk reduction measures in place.
Yoon Sun, would you agree with that with regard to the resumption of military-to-military communications, that it's unlikely that that will happen anytime soon?
Well, on the official level, it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. And I would say there are two reasons. The first one, of course, is a superficial reason that the Chinese keep saying that while our defense minister is still under sanction, we're not going to talk to you, which is a real reason. But if you think about the technicality, there are ways to avoid that. For example, if the defense minister don't talk to each other, it doesn't mean that the working level dialogue cannot be resumed, right? So that's the first reason. But the second reason is actually the more fundamental one, which is the Chinese are trying to impose structural changes to the U.S. military activity in China's periphery, and not just in terms of the Taiwan Strait, but also in East China Sea, also in South China Sea. What the Chinese have made it loud and clear is that they find the U.S. military activity near the Chinese territorial waters and near the Chinese airspace to be threatening. And they want to change that. And the way that they have tried to change that U.S. behavior is by imposing risks, by these provocative behaviors to deter, basically, the U.S. military activities in China's periphery. And I don't think it is effective so far because U.S. is operating within the normal limit of the international law. And I think the Chinese understand that. But the problem is they will continue this provocative, risky behavior until either they see some changes on the U.S. part, or there is going to be some level of small crisis between the two militaries. And then the two sides can sit down and talk about the rules of engagement and what is allowed and what is not allowed. One thing is clear, the Chinese identify that 2023 is not a year that U.S. will want to open another front of conflict with China because the war in Ukraine is still ongoing. So they would identify the U.S. tolerance for risk in 2023 at this time is actually pretty low. So for China, that gives them significantly more mental cushion that they can engage in this risky behavior without necessarily getting into a military conflict.
You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Bonnie Glaser, she's director of the Asia Program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and Yoon Sun, she's senior fellow and co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center. We are discussing the significance and outcome of the recent face-to-face talks between the United States and China. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, back to you, Bonnie Glaser. Last week, after the visit between Blinken and his counterpart and, of course, Xi Jinping in China, President Biden made a remark in California comparing Xi Jinping to a dictator. Of course, the Chinese were very upset about this. Do you think this language will have any lasting impact on the relative progress that was made in the talks?
I don't think that Biden's comment will completely derail the progress that was made. And I think your listeners should know this isn't the first time that Biden has made such comments about Xi Jinping. There was a time that he referred to Xi Jinping as a thug in his State of the Union address earlier this year. In his prepared remarks, there was no inclusion of what he actually said at one point, which was, who would want to be in the shoes of Xi Jinping? That was completely unscripted. And so there have been previous times when Biden has said things that I think very much irritated the Chinese and insulted Xi Jinping. At this particular moment, it is particularly unfortunate that he has called Xi Jinping a dictator and said that he knew nothing about what was going on with the balloon, which I think is true, in fact, but perhaps suggests that Xi Jinping doesn't always know what's going on inside his country and what the PLA is doing. But it's the dictator comment that I think has more negative impact. And so my view is that in this overall bilateral relationship, the most important communication channel is between the top leaders, between President Biden and Xi Jinping. And I think over time, that communication channel has lost some of the trust that it had early on, because those two leaders met a lot when they were vice president. They went to each other's hometowns. They did build, I think, a rapport. And I just think that has eroded over time, in part because of Xi Jinping and his actions, and in part because of Biden's statement and his actions. So there are many reasons, I think, to believe that this relationship is not as strong as it was perhaps a few years ago.
Indeed. Well, Yun Sun, anything to add or subtract? I guess one couldn't really characterize Xi Jinping as a Democrat, but this was an unfortunate choice of words, especially the timing coming right on the heels of these talks. But do you foresee any lasting damage?
I don't think there's going to be lasting damage. Do the Chinese like the term? Probably not. But are they realistic and practical enough to understand that the processes that the Blinken visit has started is of higher importance for them? I think they do, because we are looking at a number of high-level visits that will be resumed. We are looking at what Chinese economy not doing well at all this year, despite their earlier hope for rebound. And we're looking at China launching its charm offensive in order to improve the relationship with the developed world, to rescue its economy and rescue its foreign trade. And Xi Jinping is looking at the November APEC summit as an opportunity to have the bilateral summit with Biden on American soil. So there are plenty of practical deliverables and issues that the Chinese want to achieve for the rest of the year. And I think those issues are going to be much more important than the private comment that President Biden made in California. So I think the Chinese will move on. They will not blow this out of proportion. And they will let the processes that have restarted with the Blinken visit to continue, and hopefully with concrete deliverables down the road.
Bonnie Glaser, turning to one other issue with regard to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and China's apparent alliance with Russia. Do you know if that was a topic that was discussed during these talks?
The Russian invasion of Ukraine, and particularly U.S. concerns about the potential provision by China of lethal aid to Russia, were on the agenda. Quite a bit of time was spent on this topic, I was told. I would say that China's relationship with Russia is not an alliance, but it is becoming closer. And there are concerns in the United States that China could provide support of a lethal nature to Russia. The Chinese provided pledges to the United States and also to other countries. There have been recent meetings between senior Chinese officials and their European counterparts where they have provided similar pledges that they will not provide lethal aid to Russia. The United States and Europe, what they're particularly concerned about is dual-use technology and instances in which Chinese companies might be providing some assistance that maybe even the Chinese Communist Party doesn't know about. We've seen this happen in the past with North Korea. After the UN sanctions were imposed early on, there were efforts in enforcement by Beijing, and there were some individual companies that seemed to circumvent the sanctions, and the United States shared that information with China. This was at a time, of course, of more cooperative relations. The relationship now is, of course, far more contentious, but I think China does not have an interest in providing massive lethal aid to Russia, or indeed any kind of lethal aid that would trigger sanctions from the United States. and would seriously damage their relationship with Europe, potentially beyond repair. Mm-hmm. And we see China working quite hard to improve relations with Europe.
Yun Sun, would you agree with Bonnie that for now, because China needs to balance its relationship with Europe and other reasons, that China will not be providing lethal support to Russia?
So far, there has not been evidence that China has supplied Russia with lethal weapons. There have been reports about China supplying technologies and parts to Iran to make drones that in the end ended up in Russia, but I wouldn't call that a direct linkage. We also need to differentiate between the Chinese companies and the Chinese government. If we're talking about a large-scale military assistance that comes from the Chinese government to the Russian military, I don't think the Chinese will do it because it's undeniable. It also destroys its relationship with Europe. But if we're talking about specific Chinese companies supplying parts, Poly Group is one of the largest defense contractors in China. They have been selling parts for armed helicopters back to Russia. And a lot of these parts were imported by Poly Group from Russia in the past decade to begin with. So I think coming to the dual-use technology and dual-use weapon system, it is a question that we need to be very specific about which entity we're talking about and what parts and what equipment are being supplied here.
That's a very good point. And as we close China-Cuba relations, Bonnie Glazer, we learned from the Wall Street Journal that China and Cuba are negotiating to establish a new joint military training facility on the island. And of course, that sparked quite a bit of alarm in Washington that it could potentially lead to the stationing of Chinese troops and other security and intelligence operations. And this would be just 100 miles off Florida's coast. To what extent should the United States be worried about this greater Chinese footprint in the Western Hemisphere?
Blinken raised the issue of the Chinese facility in Cuba. There's already several listening posts that the Chinese and the Cubans jointly run in Cuba. And we have known about this even before 2019. But the question now is whether they're trying to build a facility where there might be training. And I think we should be concerned about the potential for China to have the ability to place forces and weapons there that could have projection capabilities that could pose a threat to the United States. So it makes sense that one has to worst case this. But the Chinese will tell you, and I'm sure Yun Sun will tell you, that the United States has bases all over the world because the United States has many allies. China has one base. It's in Djibouti. It is building dual-use facilities, I think, elsewhere around the world. There is apparently a base being built in Cambodia, and there are many others that I think are going to turn into at least dual-use facilities. This is an ambition that China has, and yes, it should not be surprising if this kind of capability is expanded very close to U.S. shores.
I wanted to close with one big question, the deepening of relations between the United States and India. Just this last week, Prime Minister Narendra Modi was here in the United States. There was a big state dinner. This is very symbolic, but also substantive. What does this have to do with China?
There's no doubt that India has become more concerned about Chinese intentions toward India, and particularly the disputed border. But the security relationship is definitely being driven by concerns about China and India's willingness to cooperate more with the United States in the defense area is, I think, largely being driven by their concerns about China. But of course, there are other things that U.S. and India have in common, both being democracies, but there's not convergence on everything. Their worldviews are somewhat different. India is very committed to a multipolar world. It does have an important relationship with China. It is, for example, a member of the BRICS organization that China is a member of and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So I would certainly not say that the U.S. and India are forming some kind of an alignment against China. But their concern about China is one of the reasons that the two countries are working together more closely in the defense area.
And the last word to you, Yun Sun.
I mentioned before that China sees its U.S.-India alignment as a threat and as a potential challenge to what China is trying to achieve in the Asia region. But I think the assessment of how deep its U.S.-India alignment will go also needs some qualification because India still follows a non-alignment strategy. It does not form an alliance with any countries. And remember, 70% of India's weapon system is still being supplied by Russia. And India's crude oil import from Russia has been significantly increased since the beginning of the Ukraine war. So I certainly wouldn't say that this relationship between U.S. and India is trouble-free.
I'm afraid on that note, that's all the time we have on this East Asia edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Bonnie Glaser, Director of the Asia Program at the German Marshall Fund, and Yun Sun, Co-Director of the East Asia Program and Director of the China Program at the Stimson Center, for a terrific and very nuanced discussion. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Do join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.